Babies know how to be born, and mothers know how to deliver. How is it that women have been giving birth on their backs for so many years? How come it is that the C-section rate in the United States of America is now at 30%, and the rest of the world is growing?
This seems so unnecessary.
When in fact, it was a king that you will hear about that instituted the process of a woman lying on her back giving birth. Please welcome to It's Rainmaking Time, Barbara Harper, founder of Waterbirth International, an RN, a childbirth advocate, a midwife, and the author of Gentle Birth Choices by Inner Traditions. Barbara, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Good morning.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are streaming the show live on the World Wide Web and will be up on satellite shortly. I'm Kim Greenhouse. I'm delighted to have you to the show. I also want to welcome an associate, Roberta Scare, the co-author of A Good Birth, A Safe Birth in its third edition, a woman who has been on the leadership team and co-founder of the Coalition for Improving Maternity Services, an editor of Genesis, the newsletter for Lamaze International, a former board member of Lamaze International and La Leche League leader for 30 years, mother of four and grandmother of one, Roberta Scare. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Good morning, Kim and Barbara. It's good to be with you.
You know, ladies, we have to talk to the public about how it is that women transitioned around the world from giving birth squatting to giving births on our backs.
You know, Kim, we touched on this subject last week, so to bring our new listeners up to speed, just a very brief overview. We talked about how women for centuries and centuries have been in charge of the process of birthing, inviting their friends, their sisters, their mothers. In every native culture around the world, it's unusual to find a man in the process. And around in the late 18th century, the 1700s, when I think we said it was Louis the 14th was having his mistresses have his babies, he decided that he wanted to watch the process. And to do that, to peek behind the curtains and watch the woman give birth, who traditionally women would sit on stools or kneel or squat, and you can't see the baby coming out that way. You just kind of stick your hands down and catch it when it pops out.
Do you literally catch it?
You literally catch it, yeah.
That's
babies
amazing.
Aren't delivered like pizza or milk. babies are caught, you know.
Wow.
It doesn't take a great deal of skill, unless there's a problem, of course. But so Louis hid behind the curtains and had the physician, the court physician, put the woman on her back, put her feet up in the air, so he could see the whole process. And, well, if it was good for the courtesans of the French regime, then it should be good for everybody, right? And so it became quickly in vogue. And that's just an example of it. But the broader scope is that medicine intervened and made childbirth a medical procedure. Yes, it saved lives, but so did washing hands.
That's
so
true.
So did good nutrition. All of those things that kind of are downplayed in the spectrum and the light of modern medical obstetrics.
Let me ask you this. When you give that information out about how the process came to be, there are going to be listeners who are asking themselves, where did you find out that information and how can they verify it?
I did this during my own pregnancy. I want everybody who's listening to, after the show, to lie down on the floor with the bottom part of their legs up on the couch so that you're in this pseudo position of having your legs up in stirrups.
We call it the stranded beetle position.
Right. So see how it feels.
Go on,
like.
Roberta.
And imagine trying to push a baby out in that position. Then stand up and gently bend your knees and visualize the same thing. And you'll feel it in your body.
Well, isn't it an obvious gravitational function as well?
Yes.
Part of it is working with gravity.
Yes.
And the body wants to be in a certain position for releasing this child.
The worst possible position for opening your cervix, opening your perineum, allowing a baby to be born, because babies know how to do this. The worst possible position is on your back. You're cutting off the blood flow to your abdominal cavity because of the weight on your vena cava. You are not allowing your coccyx, which kind of has a hinge on it. It's kind of a swing door, and it gives you more space when you're upright. You just go back into history and look at drawings, wood carvings, things like that. I've researched Middle East. You know, how was Christ born? Christ was probably born with Mary, either with one foot up on a bale of hay or straw and one foot down on the floor, or just plain old kneeling.
So biologically, this is how it's always been, and now the complete opposite is in place. When you said, Barbara, that babies know how to do this, and you said this to me on the phone several weeks ago, and it blew my mind, that babies know how to be born. Can you articulate what you mean by that? Because that's a very big statement when you really let it in. What do you mean babies know how to be born?
Well, not very many people understand the chemical and hormonal processes that go between the mother and the baby. And labor, the process of the contractions of the uterus that open the cervix to allow the baby to emerge, labor begins by the release of a hormone from the baby's pituitary gland. And scientists and researchers for the last 15 to 20 years have been looking at our DNA. They've been looking at the chemicals that are released in the baby's brain and in the mother's body that control all these processes of sexuality and birth and maturation of the baby and labor. And it's an incredible orchestra of working together. Mother's body grows the baby and releases the baby. Baby's body grows to a certain point, says, okay, it's time, I'm ready, and then has to go through an innate process that says, first I go this way, then I go that way, then, and it has nothing to do other than follow that innate process that's within its brain cells. And the baby must complete those movements to be a whole and complete human being.
So this is already, it's kind of like something that's in the works, ready to be played out, almost like an executable program.
Well, when the baby molds to the mother's body, so that's another good reason why the mother shouldn't have anesthesia for most normal births, because the baby is molding and changing how it's moving down through the mother's perineum to be born. So it's not pre-programmed. The baby responds to the mother,
exactly.
And the mother responds to the baby.
Again, it's a concert in motion, and motion is the key here. When a woman is tied down to a bed, she's not moving her body. When she's anesthetized with an epidural from her upper body all the way down, when she can't feel anything, she can't change positions to accommodate for the baby to change slight positions as well. So in this concert, in this what I call a birth dance, she needs to be active. There are many books and scientific research that will tell you that the best way to keep a labor going is to be active, to move, to squat, to walk, to rock in a rocking chair, to get in a tub of water, to float, to do anything but be in a bed, lie on your back, and not move.
How does the medical establishment face itself then? And when you really think about the climbing C-section rates, how does any OBGYN face themselves knowing what the body is established organically does and what the process is, what the process has always been? How could the public and how could the medical establishment allow this process to be, I think, seized, controlled, and then a sustained ownership of it? I don't understand how that's possible.
Well, the two words, control and ownership of it, explain it, I think. The fear. Go ahead, Barbara.
Well, also, let's put on the OB glasses for a moment. And I'm a highly trained specialist in the pathology of pregnancy and birth. I'm looking for things to go wrong. I have my glasses on, and the more I can control the situation by monitoring every heartbeat of the baby, by controlling the amount of fluid that the woman gets, by giving her an IV, by taking away any of her pain perceptions, by giving her drugs, by speeding up labor by with artificial hormones, by slowing her labor down by drugs, I can now control the process. And why do I want to control the process? Because I want a 100% assurance that we're going to have a live baby. And the great unknown of natural childbirth and giving the woman control is just that. The outcome is unknown. And for the obstetrician, he equates safety with survival.
Having said that, the research shows that when you intervene, in fact, you can cause what's called a cascade of interventions and problems that is not good for the mother and baby, and you don't get as good an outcomes with most mothers as you would if you avoided those interventions.
Stand by, please. Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. We are streaming this segment on birth, a gentler birth, with Roberta Scare and Barbara Harper. And we are introducing you to the fact that birth has been taken over by the medical establishment and turned into a medical procedure. We are invoking the call to bring birth back to an organic process that is actually safer and more reliable and always has been. And please continue.
I want to talk about water birth.
Let's talk about water birth. Many years ago, I actually heard about water birth, and I thought to myself, that sounds interesting. It certainly sounds more enjoyable than laying on your back with your feet in stirrups. However, the first thing I thought was, okay, if a baby's born in water, it's going to die because it's going to suffocate, it's going to drown. Can somebody please tell the public, is that true?
Well, of course it's not true, because we're edging close to 250,000 water babies in the world, and that's over the last 20 years, but still the movement is growing incredibly quickly as women discover the amazing benefits of allowing water to support their larger bodies and the weight of the baby, and to give them autonomy. That tub, when you get into a bathtub or a birth pool that has enough water in it to make you buoyant, and buoyancy, if we go all the way back to physics, it's called the Archimedes principle.
What is that?
Well, you put an object in water, and if you have enough water, if the water is deep enough, at some point the object then rises to the surface and becomes buoyant.
Sounds like it's rainmaking time to me.
Definitely. We need lots of water.
We're buoyant over here.
Yeah.
Well, let's just take, for instance, let's say a woman is 200 pounds when she kind of waddles into the labor room, okay, or it, you know, goes into labor, just for an example. And when she gets into the birth pool, she loses 75% of her body weight. So she's now 50 pounds. And so a woman who...
Is that true? Is that literally true?
Literally true on scientific and physics principles, yes. If the water is deep enough to cause buoyancy.
How deep does she have to be?
I want to break it. If this is a great way to lose weight, I want our listeners to know.
Ladies, I'm going into water immediately.
Okay.
Don't talk to me after this show. I'll be in my bathtub.
All you have to do is be in a bathtub that's about 20 inches deep.
20 inches deep? I'm writing this down.
20 inches deep. The bathtubs that Water Birth International creates and rents and sells to hospitals and birth centers and midwives and couples all over the world are 24 inches in depth, and you fill it to about 20 inches. So that gives you enough room to move. Once your body becomes buoyant, you don't have the effects of gravity. You have all the weight taken off of your legs, your thighs, your joints, it's easier to move. Just get into your hot tub or a swimming pool and see how you feel.
But then here, wait, hold on 1 second. Stand by right there. Then, if that's so, for the listening public, since if we were naturally squatting back in time in order to give birth, and then it got converted and we were on our backs, the gravity effect of squatting helped the baby come out. In this case, what you're saying is that with water birth, you don't even have to depend on gravity. Is that true?
Babies know how to come out. Yes, absolutely.
Barbara, I want you to talk about why babies don't drown, though.
Yeah.
Let's get back to that question. And water birth has been around for a long time.
How long? Roughly.
As long as women have, some anthropologists would take us all the way back to, you know, 1.5 million years ago when our cousins came out of the trees and went down to the savanna in Africa, and it was so hot that they went to the ocean side and actually did everything in the water. They had sex in the water. They delivered their babies in the water. They lived on the beach and did everything in the water.
What cousins are you referring to? Because my cousins still live in the trees. What about the ones you're referring to?
Well, there's anthropological studies and books about that possibility, that we had a water interlude in our evolution.
I believe that.
If we look at, we're the only mammal that has the long hair. We've lost all our body hair. That's because we lived in the water so long. And our breasts float. They're floating things. So we are more an aquatic mammal than a land mammal for some anthropologists. But all of those things have been written about, and I wrote a little bit about that in my book, Gentle Birth Choices. And I'll expand on that theory in my next book that's coming out called Water Birth, Embracing the Miracle. So the miracle is that this baby grows in a fluid environment. The baby is 9 months inside the womb, which has a fluid-filled sac in it called the amniotic fluid. And that baby does not breathe in there. The baby gets all of its oxygen from the placenta, which is attached to the mother, and the umbilical cord is attached to the baby. And so it's got this lifeline attached to it. When it comes out into the water, that lifeline is still attached. It doesn't know that it basically has been born yet. And it's receiving still all of its oxygen in the same safe, steady state that it always has when it was inside the mother.
I think that's what people don't associate with water birth.
Well,
they don't know.
Well, in the hospital, they cut the cord immediately, and the baby goes off to, you know, the warmer and gets dried and checked out. And in the water, the baby remains attached to that cord for a very long time comparatively. And
what
somebody,
is it, minutes? Is
somebody,
it minutes?
Somebody gently lifts the baby up, places it, or the mother herself lifts the baby up out of the water and into her arms immediately. And we don't recommend cutting the cord until the placenta has been delivered or the pulsations have stopped completely.
Why is that?
Because that baby needs the blood from the placenta. That baby thrives on that extra blood from the placenta. You're depriving the baby of an enormous amount of blood and oxygen when you cut that cord immediately.
Some people may not understand that. Can you expound? When you cut the cord immediately, it invokes a state of emergency, if you will? Is that what you're leading to?
It forces the baby to become a land mammal, air-breathing individual, and cuts off its oxygen supply that it still is getting from its mother. It's still pumping blood from the mother's placenta into the baby when you cut it immediately. It normally pumps for anywhere from, on the low side, 5 minutes to, on the high side, 20 minutes.
There isn't any research that shows that cutting the cord early is better for the baby.
And there's research now that shows just the opposite, that they've taken babies who are born by cesarean section and done a double-blind study, and just even allowing the cord to pulsate for one full minute after the baby is delivered by cesarean out of the womb, and just 1 minute, 60 seconds, gives the baby twice as much oxygen. The babies do better, and they leave the intensive care unit sooner. This was with premature babies, by the way.
That's amazing. One minute.
It would help even 30 seconds, you know?
Do you think that this...
I'm pretending I'm a listener here, and Barbara, I didn't hear you say that you know better than anyone that it's when the baby's face it's the air.
I was getting there. Thank you, Roberta.
I think, Roberta, you're acting as a midwife today.
Yeah.
think I'm a spectator that thinks they're a host.
I think Kim is doing us a favor. Kim is doing us a favor by going, oh, my God, I didn't know that, you know? Because there's so many things, if we look at the normal physiology of normal birth, at the actual physiology of what goes on, you know, that we've already said that it's best to move in labor. We've already said that a woman should be not on her back, but be up in any different position other than her back. And these are the things that validate normal physiology. And one of the amazing things about water birth is, okay, the mom can have that ability to reach down. The baby actually floats in the water. And
how do you know it's alive if it's floating?
Well, we know it's alive because it's got a heartbeat. And
who's in the water measuring the heartbeat?
The midwife.
This is a full service bureau. We've got a midwife in there. We have the birthing mother and a floating baby.
She's leaning over the tub.
Kim.
Yeah. Please clue us in. I'm clueless.
Let's not make light of the subject because.
Oh, I want to make light of the subject.
Well, it's okay. It's all right.
I'm being reprimanded over the air, but the reason I said that, Barbara, is that if you go into people's imagination of what it actually sounds like, think of it. You're saying that the baby's going to be floating. You know, you're also saying there's a midwife in the tub.
There's not a midwife in the tub.
Oh, there isn't?
There's a midwife
present. Present, okay.
That tub is a sacred space for the mother, often the father. Go out to my website, waterbirth.org, and look at the photographs. And look at the photographs of the babies' faces when they're just born. These babies are alert. They're awake. They're aware. I've seen babies underwater open their eyes and stretch their limbs and say, oh, my gosh, that was tight and cramped, and now I can stretch out. I call the birth tub an expanded womb, a womb with a view. They're still connected to the placenta and the umbilical cord. They're still getting oxygen. And within the matter of no more than 10 seconds, someone scoops the baby up very gently, places it in the mother's waiting arms. And you know that the baby's in a safe and steady state because all throughout the birth, all throughout the labor, you've been listening to the baby with a fetal Doppler. It's a stethoscope that is specially used underwater. And you can hear that the baby has a good heartbeat, and we don't deliver babies underwater who aren't in a good and safe and steady state. If there's a problem with the baby during the labor, the mother exits the tub. She gets out, and then you proceed with the birth in more of a medical fashion if there's any problem whatsoever. This isn't something that we do haphazardly. This isn't something that we recommend for all women across the board because you have to be healthy, number one. For a woman to have the options of a non-medical birth, she has to be in a non-medical position. So we're not saying that every baby across the world, you know, that we should abandon cesareans and all of that. We're not advocating that at all. We're advocating a combination of high tech and high touch that gives the woman autonomy to birth her baby the way she knows innately how to do and respects the baby as a conscious participant in this birth process.
That's very evolutionary. There's going to be people, for example, my younger sister Jackie had a C-section. She had two boys, twins. And probably if I were to share this with Jackie, she would say to me, well, if I had to have a C-section, I may have lost my babies, my young boys, you know, had I not been in the hospital. So, quote, thank God I was in the hospital for that to happen, when, in effect, it could very well be that she went into needing a C-section because of the way the entire birth process was undertaken from the beginning. Am I correct?
Well,
yes.
Yes.
Possibly?
Yes, on the bigger picture. We cannot, you know, we can always use anecdotes to make points. But what we do know is that the C-section rate in this country is obscene.
Didn't it grow? Didn't it grow significantly? What is the statistics on the growth rate?
Was it the 70s when it was 5%?
It's 1965. It was 5%.
And Suzanne Armes wrote a book called Immaculate Deception. Mm-hmm. enraged that the C-section rate was in epidemic proportions. It had reached 11% when she wrote her book.
When I went to France in 1984 to meet Frédéric Laboyer and Michel Audin and view their hospitals and look at what Michel Audin created in the hospital, it was a general hospital way out in the farm country, 100 miles south of Paris, in a place called PTVA. In PTVA, they created what they called a salle sauvage, which is a comfortable room for women to be in so that they didn't feel like they were in a hospital. No obstetric bed, you know, pillows all around and like a double wide futon, rocking chairs and cradles for the babies. And it was very, very pleasant. And then they pull a curtain and there's a large 5 foot round, 24 inch high bathtub. And the women got into it to ease their labor. Why did they create the salle sauvage? Because they were worried about the threatening increase in C-sections to 7%. You know, it was a way for them to normalize the labor process, to take away the things that threatened women. Because what do women need during labor? They need quiet. They need darkness. They need to create their own little cave that they can go into in their mind. You don't want them in their cerebral cortex. You want them in their hindbrain or their reptilian brain that says, every woman before me for the last billion years has given birth, and I know how to do this genetically and chemically and physically. And the more you destimulate the birthing environment, the easier it is for a woman to go into that place. And that's why the birth pool is so good, because it creates this safety net for her. It gives her a sacred space that she goes into that her provider does not go into, maybe her husband goes into. They can be intimate in that space, and she can birth her baby.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. We are streaming this segment on gentler birth on the World Wide Web. We will be up on a satellite broadcasting soon, and we are here with Barbara Harper and Roberta Scare, and we are talking about water birth and safe birth choices. And also at this moment, we are talking about the escalating statistics having to do with C-sections. Roberta, you said when we spoke last week that in other countries of the world, was it Argentina, there's a 90% C-section rate?
Actually, according to the Wall Street Journal, China has the highest overall rate at 47%, and Puerto Rico and Brazil have 45%, according to some obstetricians that I met. There are, however, many city hospitals where almost every woman has a cesarean. And there's a hospital outside Denver. I just heard about a new hospital where the cesarean rate is 80%. So, but you look at the national rate. So, I mean, this is not normal. This is not, it cannot be good for mothers and babies.
It can't be good for the insurance industry either, who we would all think would be very interested in what you're doing.
We pay for this. It cannot be good to have major surgery performed on most women's bodies to have a baby be born with all the risks. And there are risks. There's a brochure called What Every Pregnant Woman Needs to Know About Cesarean Section 2004, put out by the Maternity Center Association, that you can get by going to maternitywise.org.
MaternityWise. Yeah, WISE. Wise up, women. Take back your birth is what they're saying.
It gives all the data that a woman could possibly need to say. It talks about risks and benefits of vaginal birth and some cesarean birth, but the comparisons are accurate. And in fact, do I need to tell our listeners, it's better for a woman and baby if she has a normal vaginal birth.
But, you know, there's listeners who are going to be thinking, they want the ultimate protection. There's this whole gestalt, which I know you both know, around protection, safety, and what that means. And people typically transfer, both men and women, protection and safety. They transfer over that power to medical practitioners and have been for many, many years.
Well, there wouldn't be organizations like the International Cesarean Awareness Network, ICANN. There wouldn't be organizations like that. There wouldn't be the fight that we're having right now if women just decided to accept what medicine is offering and say, sure, let's cut every baby out. It's safer. It's not that. We are a process-oriented people, especially women, and we know inherently that the process of labor and birth is necessary for the continuation of our species. And the doctors would have us think that we are product-oriented. Just put me in the hospital, give me my baby, and I'll go home. That's why women got off their backs and started screaming about anesthetized birth in the 50s and the 60s. We had this whole incredible movement with the creation of Lamaze, with the creation of
ICEA,
and La Leche League back in the 60s when women took back the night and said, hey, this isn't any good. You know, that's when I went to nursing school, was just after 1970, and they were still anesthetizing women. It was knock them out, drag the babies out. We call it knock them out, drag them out obstetrics. Well, it's kind of going back to that now. And if women think that they are getting choice by demanding cesarean section and saying, you know, I don't want to feel labor, we've got to go back to them and educate them and say, why is it necessary for the continuation of our species in the way that we know it to have a normal vaginal birth? Why is it necessary? Nobody's focusing on the baby. And you know, I'm a huge baby advocate. And that's one reason that I started Waterbirth International, was to save babies. Because waterbirth is the gentlest approach for giving birth for the babies.
I've heard that you've transitioned over 100 hospitals into
200.
To over 200 hospitals. That's a lot of hospitals.
Well, that's it isn't me personally.
It's to water birth.
It's the message. Mm-hmm. It's the message, and I've been giving the message for 20 years that we have to look at the way we welcome babies. And water birth is just a little part of that. It's called, I call it the Kmart effect. When we put a water tub into a hospital unit, women normally gravitate to there. Let's talk about the hospital in Keene, New Hampshire, Cheshire Medical Center. Cheshire Dartmouth, it's part of the Dartmouth College Medical Centers. And in that hospital, they took a look at their high cesarean section rate, which was then 20-some percent, 25, 26 percent. And they looked at their high rates of induction. They looked at their high rates of epidurals. And they had a forward-thinking obstetrician, a woman, who said, you know, I had a cesarean section for my first baby. I don't necessarily want to do that again. Let's look at what we're doing to induce that, to cause that, as an obstetrician. Very forward-thinking. And so they made a plan, and they got everybody together, and they looked at what can we do to make birth normal. We can have women move. Oh, take them off the monitor. And if you look at all of the studies about fetal monitoring, they all say the same thing. They do not produce a healthier baby. They do not give you better statistics. They increase cesarean section.
That's amazing.
So they said, take the women off the monitors. You know, only get a strip necessary for risk management. And view birth as normal and healthy. Give the woman continuous labor support. Give her a doula, and we'll go into that in a minute. But give her a woman there to give her comfort and ease her pain by compassion, not drugs. And give her the ability to choose any position that she wants to give birth. If she wants to squat, if she wants to be on the floor, if she wants to be in the bed, if she wants to sit on the toilet, if she wants to be in the bathtub. And most of all, no routine interventions. No, don't do.
What does that mean?
Don't do things that we do just because we've always done it. Break her water. The minute she walks through the door, break her water. Start an IV. Take her off of all food and drink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't do that routinely. Only do it when it's necessary medically. We have so many routines. It's like a telephone book, you know, with the rules that women don't even know what they are. But ask women, ask at your hospital, do you routinely break my water? Do you routinely put a monitor on the baby's scalp? Do you routinely deny me food and drink when I'm in labor? And if they say yes, turn and go to another hospital. So in Keene, at this hospital, Cheshire Medical Center, they evaluated all of those things. And they said, let's provide a doula for every woman. Let's put bathtubs in every room. And in the space of 3 years, their cesarean section was reduced from 26% down to 14%. That's and has remained there for an additional 2 years.
That's remarkable. If you could stand by, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to go to a commercial break for about 5 or 6 minutes. We ask that you listen. We have an event in Los Angeles today, and we'll be back with the section on water birth. For those of you who are in Los Angeles this weekend, there is a wonderful convention, the 32nd Annual Cancer Convention with the Cancer Control Society, and it's at the Sheraton Universal at 333 Universal Terrace Parkway in Universal City. And we are here with Frank Cozzano, the Vice President of the Cancer Control Society, who's here at this convention. Good morning, sir.
Oh, good morning. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad you're here because I want you to really settle some distortion that many of us have out in the public. I have talked to many people who have said that if cancer solutions existed, that certainly they would be available through hospitals and doctors and major medical periodicals and magazines, that we would hear about it on Reuters and all the major news broadcasts, and certainly all the organizations who are working so hard and so diligently for the last 25 years would be touting the latest wonder cures. So what possibly would people be gathering for in Universal City this weekend, starting at 9 a.m. with registration at 8 for the Cancer Control Society? What the heck is going on?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, cancer has been studied for many years. There's the government has put a tremendous amount of money into what it calls research. Private foundations have channeled money into so-called research, but it's all been pretty much a single facet type of research, either drug or radiation, and very little or none going into the area of diet, environment, and all the other factors that figure into any degenerative disease. And people often tell me the same thing. That, oh, well, if there were an answer, if there were a cure, if there were something, it would already be in the newspaper and it would be at the local hospital. And all of us are products of how we're brought up, how we're taught in school, and what we've learned. And we know, those of us, it's been a few years since I was in college, but we had certain professors that had a certain agenda, and no matter what the class, they would use the agenda to teach a particular agenda. And others had a different agenda. Some didn't seem to have any agenda other than a search for truth. And what the Cancer Control Society is about is a search for truth, but in such a way that we would like to present all the information that's available and allow the individual to make the choice, or the individual and his doctor make that choice.
You said something really profound to me just before we got on the air, which was that the disease that we know as cancer is actually easier to treat than the politics of it.
Well, that's very true. And a number of people have documented this. And what we have here is back around shortly after the turn of the century, we had foundations, tax-free foundations, that were set up to shield money, wealth of some of the super rich from taxation, so they could pass it on to future generations. And some of those people decided to reform medical schools. So they started to change the curriculum and say, we have to have scientific studies, we have to have double blind, we have to do all of these things. Well, if you set the parameters for a study, you can predetermine the outcome. And if you have an economic interest in the outcome, it's very easy to see how it could be manipulated. If you control the school, either through grants, and if you're a drug company and you're providing money for a medical school, the medical school is going to look to you for direction on what to teach. And if you have an anti-cancer drug, then that's what's going to be taught. And cancer drugs, drugs for cardiovascular disease, are very expensive. Takes a long time to develop. The regulatory process, I believe, has deliberately been made very cumbersome so that only people, institutions with a lot of money can afford to get through them. If you take natural substances like vitamins, like minerals, or like treatments that don't involve expensive processes, can't be patented, that anyone can probably do out of reading a book or a group of physicians get together and study methods and do it with their own patients, it eliminates the economic incentive for these companies to continue funding higher education, grants, studies. And it also removes control of the medical process from the doctors, from the schools, and from the government regulatory apparatus. If patients and doctors are allowed to utilize whatever methods they believe will work in a particular situation.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the Vice President of the Cancer Control Society, who is here in Los Angeles at the Sheraton Universal at 333 Universal Terrace Parkway. And the Cancer Control Convention begins today at 9 o'clock in the morning with registration at 8, all the way through Monday, September 6th. If you're interested, you can pay $10 at the door and come, or if you want to just see the exhibits, or you can go to the booths, you can prowse around and talk to people, and or you can go to the actual lectures that are happening for $35 per day. And I want to thank you for being with It's Rainmaking Time, and thank you for your work and dedication. And we hope to have you back to talk more about both the opportunities of the research and the solutions surrounding cancer, and also how can we make the politics less political.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here, and look forward to seeing your audience at the Sheraton Universal this weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back to It's Rainmaking Time. We are streaming the show live on the World Wide Web. We are here with Barbara Harper, the founder of Water Birth International, and Roberta Scare. We welcome you back, and now I'd like to invite you all to call in on our 800 number. We'd like to hear from you and address your questions to Barbara Harper and Roberta Scare on water birth. And the call-in number, ladies and gentlemen, write this down, is 1-877-625-3724. Let me repeat, we want to hear from you. We'd really like your audience participation at 877-625-3724. And because three's the charm, I'm going to take it from the top and do it again. 1-877-625-3724. We'd like to hear from you wherever you're streaming this show in the United States of America, whether it's in Europe or Canada. We'd like to hear from you. Okay, in the meantime, while people are either getting ready to call, thinking they're going to call, wondering if they should call, or calling, let's come back to It's Rainmaking Time.
Hey, Kim, I think I want to go down to L.A. to that cancer conference. That sounds great.
It's a wonderful conference here right through Monday of this week. And I think it's Labor Day, no pun intended.
Well, it gave me a chance to think about what the conference is doing is offering empowerment of individuals. And that's what water birth does, and that's what normal birth does. Barbara was talking about the placing the emphasis on how good it is for the baby to have a normal birth. But I also want to...
We do have a caller, by the way, but go right ahead.
You can't separate the mother and the baby, and I know Barbara never does this. What's good for the baby is good for the mother, and at some point I'd like us just to talk a little bit about the ecstasy and empowerment that you can have in a normal birth.
Okay, that may end up being another show. As we have about 12 minutes left, we have Roberta on the line from North Carolina. Good morning and welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Good morning, good morning. I couldn't believe this is a better show than last week. I like to say that on a metaphysical level, it seems that underwater birth gives the soul the exact and perfect birth time astrologically. Induced birth, especially with the C-sections that have been talked about this morning, take away every opportunity that the soul has to have an exact birth time. And a lot of people get their lives very messed up because the birth time is not correct. So these women are on absolutely the right path. I just thought that I'd bring in another aspect of it.
Roberta, could you please share, take just 1 minute and give your credentials, your background, and the work you're in that you could say such a statement?
Yes. My work for more than 33 years has been as a reader of the Akashic Records. And these are records of lifetimes that people have lived. And the birth time is very important. I'm not an astrologer, but the time of birth that people have is down to the nanosecond. And when you have a birth, I'm real clear on this, when you have a birth that is induced just because the doctor wants to go out and golfing, I'm smiling, is very, very bad for the soul. And I find that a lot of people who've talked with their mother, and when the mother has said, yes, I had an induced birth, I had a C-section, or they did whatever that they did, and it was not a water birth and whatever, their lives have been very messed up. It's kind of like they're always missing something in their life because nothing is meshed. There's no meshing in their life that makes things on a very nice continual plane. So the work that these women are doing is phenomenal to bring the correct way of birthing in, which gives the exact birth time. There are a lot of children that are born that are in incubators and they're not breathing very well. The soul has not come into the body. So my work has been over more than 3 decades, and I'm real clear about this, and this is a wonderful show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is important that we allow babies to time their birth, and that's a very important point, because birth shouldn't be hurried at all. And when we medicalize birth and institutionalize it, we put it on a clock. And I have a very cute film from Switzerland where the midwives go over, and the first thing in the film is they go over and it's like a silent movie, but they go over and they take the clock off the birth room wall, they walk over, they open the garbage pail, and they plop the clock into it. And birth has to be on its own schedule and its own time. And we wait for the baby, and we do, just like Roberta said in the beginning, that the mother accommodates to the baby and the baby accommodates to the mother. And it becomes this wonderful dance. Well, when you walk into the hospital, let's take for example, if your membranes, your water has broken, your water breaks on the floor of your kitchen, and you don't go into labor right away, but you go to the hospital and have a consultation with them, they want that baby delivered in some places no more than 12 hours later. And they will do things to speed up the labor or to initiate it, or they'll do a cesarean section because they want the baby delivered. Why do they want the baby delivered? Yes, there are studies that say that you have an increased risk of infection, but there's also opposite studies that say you can wait safely up to 72 hours without a greater risk of infection. So we're asking for that happy medium, and fortunately there are some great studies now out of Sweden that were published that you can wait that 72 hours and still have a water birth. One of my second most often asked questions is, won't I get an infection if I sit in the water, if I poop in the water, if I pee in the water, all of that. It's your body. It's your, you know, your germ and environment. And the answer is no. The body of water kind of takes care of any possibility of infection whatsoever.
Do you think that people actually believe that part regarding bacteria? If you're excreting in the water, do you think that the common person believes that?
Or oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, yes. I get that question many, many times. I sit in an office in Portland, Oregon, and when I'm not lecturing, and I'm here 14 to 15 hours a day, and we get hundreds of emails. Our website gets 200,000 hits a month. 200,000 hits a month. Women want this information. Let me digress just a tiny bit. I want to finish what the statistics are in Keene, New Hampshire.
And we have about 7 minutes, so just
yeah,
so you
very
know time
very
was. Sure,
quickly,
that's okay.
Very quickly, in that time period where they reduced their cesarean section rate to 42%, they fired their anesthesiologist because women, when they take a bath, don't want epidurals, and they have a 42% rate of water birth, 42%. So when we're talking that some hospitals have a 42% cesarean section rate, this hospital has a 14% cesarean section rate. By World Health standards, that's normal. The World Health Organization says for tertiary care centers, we should not have a higher cesarean section rate than 15%. For rural hospitals and small hospitals, it should be no more than 10%. And so we are aghast that it is moving in the direction of 30% or greater.
I want to go back to Roberta's question. Hi, Roberta. It's nice to meet somebody named like me. What I'm feeling is this synchronicity of information. The information in every facet of our knowledge is saying the same thing, that we should go within for our wisdom, that we should go within to make our decisions. We should go within to understand our timing when things should happen. So I just find that very interesting that the actual medical data supports waiting and not intervening in birth. And philosophically, it also says that.
And pre and perinatal psychology, which is a burgeoning field, has studies and reports. The Association for Pre and Perinatal Psychology and Health, called APA, and their website is wombpsychology.com. They advocate absolutely having that baby have a complete process from the moment of conception all the way through to the birth, that the baby follow its innate cues, including the timing of the birth. Otherwise, it's like a puzzle piece. Just what Roberta from North Carolina was saying, it's a puzzle that's missing a few pieces. And no matter how you try to put that puzzle back together, if you don't have all the ingredients for that puzzle, it's never going to be whole and complete.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. We have been broadcasting a segment on gentler birth choices with Barbara Harper, the founder of Water Birth International and the author of Gentle Birth Choices, along with Roberta Scare, the author of A Good Birth, A Safe Birth in its third edition. And I want to thank both of you for being on the show today. I'd like all of you to know that this show is about bringing ancient and new knowledge to the public. It's about bringing in the details and truth-telling of those things, those events and situations around the world that need to be told. It's about bringing you solutions that are not only here but have been here probably for millions of years that are buried or lost or being suppressed. It's about serving the public good, and the public good is the greater good. It's also about bringing you good news. Good news, modern-day discoveries, discoveries that will allow you to have better choices, more capable lives, and more full lives. And this show really is about assisting humanity in continuing in a different way than the course that we're on. And it's an honor to bring you this show. My intent is to have the show be available all over the world, both in radio and television. I'm Kim Greenhouse. I produce the show on a public access level in the Los Angeles area. And I'm very much looking forward to the show being broadcast on satellite in as many distribution channels as possible. It could be said that the state of the world in radio today could use a different kind of boost of energy and possibility and detail. And with that also has to come a different brand and generation of advertising and financial support. And that financial support has to come from something I call the current behind the currency, which means that the financial support of radio and television needs to be backed by a consciousness and frequency that's at the same level or higher of the product or programming that's being provided. And typically what happens is that people are so glad to get on the air and get their show and their works aired that they'll take money and sponsorship from anywhere. And this leaves a kind of incongruent, discordant element, which means that once you get going and you get funded, and the advertising comes from a different frequency than the broadcasting or programming side, that if, God forbid, you push the envelope of human thought or imagination, or you go beyond where people are looking or think is going on in the world, your funding could be pulled. So I want all of you to know that 7 minutes of advertising space is available on the World Wide Web for the show that's streaming. I also want you to know that it is through the World Wide Web that new knowledge, ancient and modern day discoveries, and truth can be told in a way that is blocked or distorted on mainstream. That includes, ladies and gentlemen, both public and private broadcasting. And don't believe for a second that everything you hear on public broadcasting is true because it's public broadcasting. I used to think that, and it's not true. And so just know that there's power in the World Wide Web. There's power in satellite, and that you will have an opportunity to meet people like Barbara Harper and Roberta Scare and Roberta Herzog because of the World Wide Web, very mighty and astounding medium for humanity. My name is Kim Greenhouse. I appreciate you listening. Thank you again.